we hearing noises? Am I doing something wrong? What is it? I'm okay? I keep hearing these little thumps. Is that my heartbeat? Evidence that I'm still alive? I wonder how long that'll last. Okay, we're in Hebrews chapter 9. And if you recall, last week we were studying the contrast between the Old Covenant and the New Covenant and the fact that the New Covenant is superior. And he started talking about in verse 16 and 17 that there must be a death for a covenant to take place. We talked about the fact that covenant, testament come from the same Greek word. But tonight he's talking about blood. And he's particularly talking about the relationship between the shedding of blood and sin. And so last week we got down to verse 22, which I found somewhat amazing. We covered 22 verses last week. That was fantastic for me. But let's read, to get back into the swing of things here, let's read verses 18 through 22, where he gets into this discussion of blood. 18 through 22. Therefore, even the first covenant was not inaugurated without blood. For when every commandment had been spoken by Moses to all the people according to the law, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop and sprinkled both the book itself and all the people, saying, "This is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you." And in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and all the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And according to the law, well, the New American Standard says, one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood, and without shedding of blood, there is no forgiveness. Come back and talk about that verse in a minute, because that's interesting translation to me. I looked at several versions on how they did this. But anyway, in these verses 18, 19, 20, 21, it's going back to what happened in Exodus chapter 24 when Moses was telling the people about the commandments and so forth, and they sprinkled blood on everything. He says they sprinkled blood on the book. And so I got to thinking about that. I assume there were bloodstains on that book every time they got it out. Probably a scroll. Every time they got it out, they saw the bloodstains on there from when everything was initiated. So there was blood everywhere. But the key factor, of course, here is in verse 19, it says, he took the blood of the calves and the goats with water and scarlet wool and hyssop. And he also sprinkled the people. Don't you know the people in the front row? We're kind of skittish because here comes all his blood he's throwing at everybody. But anyway, that's what he does. And so he's making the point to them. You all are familiar with this blood thing with regard to the relationship to forgiveness of sins and blood. And you know that there was no forgiveness of sins with this blood. The sins were remembered with this blood. He'll tell us later on in this book. But he says here, this is the blood, in 20, this is the blood of the covenant which God commanded you. But it was animal blood. Which covenant? First covenant. The Old Testament. So he says, even that covenant was inaugurated with blood, but it was animal blood, so it was inferior. And then it says, in the same way, he sprinkled both the tabernacle and the vessels of the ministry with the blood. And then verse 22 is a really interesting verse to me. I'd be curious to hear how some of your other translations have this, but verse 22, if you got the New American Standard, and like I told you, I love this translation because I think it's very accurate, but I don't understand what they did here in 22 because this is not what the original Greek text says. But it tells you in verse 22, there are some italicized words, and that means that these words were added by the translator, of course. So they admit these words are not in the Greek text. For whatever reason, they changed the meaning. The way this ought to read and the way the true Greek reads is, and according to the law, almost all things are cleansed with blood. And without shedding of blood, there's no forgiveness. Now, does anybody have, other than the New American Standard, a translation that says something different from that? The New American Standard says, one may almost say all things are cleansed with blood. Where'd they get that? I don't know. What does yours have, Troy?
New King James.
okay, but yours doesn't say, one may almost say, does it? Yes. I tried to explore that a little bit and see why they did that. There must be something about the original Greek that gives you the ability to translate this another way. I don't quite get it. I guess you could say the meaning comes out the same. Yeah, and what Troy said is what the New American Standard says if you take out the italicized words. Yeah. Say it louder. I couldn't hear you. Isn't that something? Well, I wish I could explain that to you all, but I can't. I don't know why that's there. And I couldn't find any other translation that has one may almost say in there. I find that kind of strange. Anybody have any explanation for that? I don't. But, you know, I guess this is one of those places where the New American Standard kind of lets me down. At least they put it in italics to let us know that this is their interpretation. So, let's take what the original says, what Troy's version says, and apparently what everybody else's version says. What it really means is, and according to the law, which law? Well, the Old Testament law, almost all things are cleansed with blood. Well, why not all things? Well, were there some exceptions under the law? Well, there are some. Yes. Yes. Some things were cleansed with water. And I found a verse back in Leviticus chapter 5. I don't want to go back and look up all these verses. You can find 10 or 15 of them where things were offered for sin that were not blood. But back in Leviticus chapter 5, it's talking about poor people who come to the temple to make an offering, and they can't afford the price. I forget what the bird is. What bird they offer? Anybody remember? I don't know, some little rinky-dink bird, which was cheap, but a poor person couldn't afford to buy the bird to make the sacrifice. So God said, in that case, you can offer some fine flour. Interesting. But the exception was only for people who were too poor to be able to buy a bird to offer. Even with the bird, though, it was offering of blood. Well, so that's true. Almost all things are cleansed with blood. And yet we know that cleansing is not forgiveness. That cleansing is atonement and remembrance. And then there's this, anybody want to comment about that? I thought that was an interesting verse. And then at the end of that verse it says, and without shedding of blood there is no forgiveness. I've tried to think a little bit about why God set it up that way. And the best I can come up with in a simple explanation is this. God demands obedience, and he won't tolerate sin. Now, what did he tell? If a man is going to sin, since the first men, Adam and Eve, were created, God's in his mind will not tolerate that unless there is a price to be paid. What does Romans 3:23 say? No. 6:23. All have sinned. No, that's 3:23. 6:23 says the wages of sin is death. Of course, we're talking about spiritual death there. But you go back to Eve. When Eve was talking to the serpent in Genesis chapter 3, the serpent's trying to get her to eat of that tree. And she says, no, I'm not going to do that, because God had said, if you eat of the tree, what's going to happen? You will die. And what did he tell Adam? He says, I wrote down, I think, what verse this is in. In Genesis, Well, I didn't write that one down, but it's a chapter or two after what he talked to Eve about. What did he tell Adam was going to be his ultimate fate? Where was he going? From where did he come, and from where was he going? Well, from dust he came, and to dust he was going to return. Well, what does that mean? He's going to die. So since the beginning, God has demanded that there be a penalty for sin, and of course that penalty for all sinners has been, we're all going to die because of that. But under the old covenant, he really gave man a break. Under the old covenant, instead of demanding man's blood, he said, I'm going to set up a system for you whereby you can offer the blood of animals as atonement for your sin. Well, who really deserved to die? Everybody who sinned. They deserve for their blood to be offered, and God's demand for justice was that every man would have to offer his own blood in death as atonement for his sin. But he said, I'm going to develop a system where instead of offering your own blood every time you sin and I zap you, what you can do is you can offer daily sacrifices and annual sacrifices of animal blood. Okay, now how did that change in the New Testament? Is he still requiring that man offer his blood because of a result of sin? No. Whose blood is now offered? The blood of Jesus. So that's what, I mean, this is so impressive. What God has done in thinking about our best interest. And he's been giving man a break ever since the beginning by not killing him and taking his life the first time he sinned. If that were the case, none of us would be here. I'm pretty sure. Anybody who's never sinned, raise your hand. I'd like to get your advice. So under the Old Testament system, he let animal blood substitute for man's blood. And under the New Testament system, he let Jesus' blood sacrifice substitute for man's blood. That's the best way I can explain that. Anybody else have any comments about that? Does that make sense? Do you all know why God did it that way? I don't, except that he will not tolerate sin. And he demands that there be a penalty for it. And that's the way he set up the system. Yeah, you said a key word there, and I actually had that one down and didn't mention it, but what you said, it's right on, and that is God is a God of justice, and he demands justice, and the essence of God is so pure and so righteous and so just that he just will not tolerate sin without there being a just compensation. And yet, out of the goodness of his heart, he said, well, they're going to mess up. So I'm going to devise a way for them to be able to get forgiveness without them having to die every time they sin. That's what he did. So he gave us a break. That's what he did. He also gave it to the Old Testament people, but he gave it to us. We've got a better deal. Okay, well, let's look at verses 23 and 24, because this is Jimmy's impressed by these verses. 23. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens. Well, we've already seen that those copies were the Old Testament things. The tabernacle, the veils, the inner veil, all that stuff. Therefore, it was necessary for the copies of the things in the heavens to be cleansed with these. Okay, what's he saying there? The copies, the Old Testament stuff, all the Old Testament paraphernalia, the tabernacle, the outer thing, the inner thing, all of that had to be, they had to be cleansed with the animal blood. But all those were was copies of the real thing, which is heaven. But the heavenly things themselves, they were cleansed with better sacrifices than these. And what he's saying is, you all get how all these old things were cleansed with animal blood, but they were just representations of the real thing. And the real thing was cleansed with much, much better blood. the blood of the Son of God. 24. For Christ did not enter a holy place. In other words, on the other side of the veil. Christ did not enter a holy place made with hands. No, it wasn't the spiritual this physical tabernacle. Because that was a mere copy of the true one, which is what? Heaven. But into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God for us. So he's trying to convince them in another way, and he's tried so many different ways up to this point, to appreciate what has been done for them with the offering of blood, which now gives them actual cleansing of their sins instead of just remembrance of their sins. And he just goes overboard with detail about the Old Testament paraphernalia and sacrifices and so forth, and high priest and all that business, trying to get them to appreciate how much better it is with the new covenant. Now, when you think of all the trouble to which God went for us, that ought to just make us tremble with gratitude when he says that Jesus, who went through all this stuff for us, is now in heaven appearing in the presence of God for us. All I can say is, wow. Jesus is now, at this moment, appearing, he's in heaven, appearing in the presence of God for us. Wow, how can we possibly appreciate that to the degree that we should? I don't know. Any comments about that? I mean, to me, that ought to make us want to try so hard to do better, to know that Jesus went through all of that and now he's in the presence of God in heaven, advocating, mediating for us. Unbelievable. Okay, 25 and 26. Yeah, oh, the cleansing is what he's talking about in the early 19 through 21. The cleansing was with this blood, and that's what he's saying. We cleansed the book itself. We cleansed all the elements of the tabernacle. We cleansed the people by throwing blood all over them. We just cleansed everything there was with the blood to the degree that animal blood could cleanse anything. So there was a difference between cleansing and forgiveness. And the copies were all the Old Testament physical things. And they were copies of the New Testament thing and what he's talking about in 24 with Jesus being in heaven. Of course, we know that when the high priest went on the other side of the veil into that inner part of the tabernacle, that's a shadow of Jesus dying to get into heaven. So there's blood cleansing going on with both systems, but the Old Testament one was the cleansing of the physical Jewish stuff with animal blood, and the new one was Jesus going into heaven and our getting cleansing and forgiveness because of his blood. I got to thinking about this forgiveness business and the Old Testament business. And let me just go back to in chapter 9 and look at two verses, which I find really interesting. Chapter 9, verse 9, which is a symbol for the present time. Accordingly, both gifts and sacrifices are offered, which cannot make the worshiper perfect in conscience. In conscience. That's an interesting way he chose to put that. Now go down to verse 14. That's about the old law. How much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit delivered, offered himself without blemish to God, cleanse your conscience from dead works to serve the living God. And verse 9, he says the Old Testament could not make the worshiper perfect in conscience. And in verse 14, he says that Christ's blood can cleanse your conscience from dead works. When you sin and you feel guilty about it, where do you feel that guilt? In your conscience. So I'm interpreting from this that the Old Testament people had some realization of the fact that their sins were not forgiven. They still felt the guilt of those sins, and they were not forgiven, but we have the ability to feel actual forgiveness because our conscience is cleansed. The memories we have of our sins, which make us feel guilty, when we ask for forgiveness or get forgiveness through our baptism originally, it's cleansed. It's the cleansing of our conscience. And you all know, surely you know, there's no worse feeling than a guilty conscience. It's a crummy feeling. But thanks to Jesus' blood, we can have our guilty conscience cleansed. Amazing. We're so blessed. So blessed. Okay, 25 and 26. Now, this is just a little practical reasoning, common sense, he says. Nor was it that he, Jesus, would offer himself often. As the high priest enters the holy place year by year with blood that is not his own. So he says Jesus didn't have to go in all the time and offer a sacrifice. He didn't have to do that often. And notice also it throws in this little thing about the high priest. As the high priest entered year by year with blood that is not his own. That's kind of a little downer on the high priest. He's coming in. He's offering animal blood. He's not making the sacrifice that Jesus made. He's offering blood that's not his own. And the contrast is Jesus came in and said, I'll offer my own blood for your forgiveness. 26. So there's a lot of good stuff in here. 26. Otherwise, if Jesus, in other words, were offering himself all the time, every time somebody sinned, he would have needed to suffer often since the foundation of the world. But and what he's saying is, if Jesus had to offer for every time somebody sinned, he'd have started with Adam and Eve, and he'd been offering every day since then. But now once, and this is a heavy verse, now once at the consummation of the ages, he has been manifested to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. He's not offering animal blood. He's not offering the blood of some other man. He's offering his own blood. But look at what he did. This is the culmination of all of history since Adam and Eve were created and until the end, whenever that comes. He talks about, but now once he was offered at the consummation of the ages. What ages? The Jewish dispensation, the patriarchal dispensation, the time when God spoke to heads of families, the whole thing. This is the consummation of the ages. This is what God has been preparing for ever since, well, before the creation, we learn. The consummation of the ages. And isn't it nice that we're on the other side of when that happens so we don't have to wonder about it? You know, the prophets of old wondered. You know, they knew they were saying really important stuff, but they didn't know what it meant. We learn from the New Testament that they wondered. They tried to look into those things and couldn't figure it out. We know. We got the answers. Jimmy?
I just can't help but see the irony here. You know, God, this is the Hebrew audience. You know, they would be well acquainted with all things related to the priesthood and what the priest did on their behalf and how God had established that to allow them this access to him, this opportunity to remit this sin, for them not to pay the penalty that they really do. The ironic part is God basically follows that same pattern and brings another high priest. And it's interesting throughout Hebrews how he's overlaying, here's your history as a people and how God has dealt with you. He's still dealing with you this way. But what he's done now is all of these things you hold near and dear, you thought they were the end all, here comes the better version. Here comes the version that gets you the eternal forgiveness that you could never have under this.
Yeah, what it was essentially saying is you have understood the physical system, now appreciate the spiritual system because it's so much better.
Yeah, the ironic part is, you know, he offers Jesus up as here is the high priest. You know, and you would think a people that are used to a system of belief could be led to see, okay, here's how it's being played.
Yeah, and what should have enhanced their appreciation for that, and ours too, is it not... It's not that he was just a high priest who did wonderful things and lived a sinless life and offered himself. He was the Son of God who came down here for the purpose of doing that. I'll have to guess, yes, based on my memory. But
it's interesting that you have a high priest in a position of sort of authority, and he's casting judgment on the high priest, the high priest that should have replaced that whole system. I believe there's a lot of irony in that, that God allowed all of that to transpire the way it did.
Yeah.
Him as a king. I mean, imagine, in another system, the king, every man fights to the death to protect the king's life, right? Our king gladly strode right up to his end, his punishment.
Yeah.
I'll go through the trials, I'll be mocked, I'll be beaten, I'll take all this upon me because there's a purpose being worked through all of this that's for all of your good, and that's the reason I'm going to do all this.
Yeah, and these first century Christians who were Jews by nationality, they remembered back what the high priest was like. I mean, he was corrupt, he was political, he was sleazy, he was dishonest, he was a liar, they were really sleazy political pawns of the Roman Empire that were as corrupt as you could possibly be. And they had to realize what that like was like. Okay, well, let's look at 27 and 28. These are, you know, I told you there's some key verses in here. One of them was verse 15. But 27 and 28 are also key verses to note. And inasmuch as it is appointed for men to die once, and after this comes judgment, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time for salvation without reference to sin to those who eagerly await him. That's really, there are several really interesting things about this. It's appointed to man to die once, and after that, the judgment. Now, what does that say about the Hindu concept of reincarnation? Well, it kind of negates it, doesn't it? I'm not going to come back as a frog or a scientist or a kangaroo or whatever else it is that Hinduism says I might come back as. It's appointed a man to die once, and after this comes judgment. And so what he's saying is, let me give you a parallel to that. Jesus was also a man. And just as it's appointed to all men to die once and then judgment, you know what? Jesus died once, and then he's going to be at judgment. But think of the different roles. Jesus' role at judgment is going to be far different from your and my role at judgment. We're going to be the judged, and he's going to be the judge. But it's really interesting that as a man, he is following the pattern that men follow. And that is, we live, we die, then we face judgment. Well, he lived, he died, and he'll be present at judgment, but not to be judged, obviously. And of course, what he's telling them is, the first time that Christ came around, he presented the truth to you. The second time he comes around, it's not going to be to offer you forgiveness of sins. It's going to be too late. So that's what he means, I think, when he says, so Christ also, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, and you responded to that because you became Christians, he will appear a second time for salvation at the second coming, for salvation without reference to sin. No longer is he coming back to offer you forgiveness or to be a sacrifice. He's already done that. And this is part of the argument where he's trying to persuade them, come on, follow through, stay with it. He's going to come back for salvation to those who eagerly await him. Well, that's us. That's really interesting. But there's a fact of life in there, and that is, and we see evidence of it all the time, that we're born, we live, we make choices to obey or not to obey and accept what God has offered to us, and then we die, and then we face the consequences of judgment. That's the pattern. Nothing's changed. And verse 28 tells us we sure have an awful lot to gain by obeying, and we have an awful lot to lose by disobeying. Any comments? Jared? Okay, Troy? You're farther away and you're taller. Go ahead. Ah, okay. Yes, turtle doves. I'm not up on my turtle doves. Did you get that from Leviticus 5:11? Thank you. Jared?
This is not necessarily, maybe not in verse 28, but I love the comparison between the first and the second coming. You know, 2 Thessalonians 1 tells us that when Jesus comes back, he's going to be glorified among his saints. He's going to be admired by the saints. That's the total opposite of the way it was for him the first time. He was despised and rejected by men. But as you said, he's coming the next time, not for forgiveness of sins, but to save those who have dedicated their lives to him. And I love this, eagerly wait for him. And I wonder, I don't know how to gauge myself if I'm eagerly waiting for him. But I hope so, and I think that's borne out by my actions and how I conduct myself every single day.
Yeah. Well, Jared was talking about, are we eagerly waiting for the return of Jesus? And there might be a little contradiction going on in people's minds. And I think this is a tougher thing for younger people, especially somebody who is, they found the love of their life, they're married, they now got three fantastic kids, or two, or one, or however many they've got, and life is grand, everybody's healthy, and they're getting all the enjoyment that God designed for us to get out of families and life and all that sort of thing. Is that person say, gee, I sure hope I die tomorrow so that I can go to heaven? And I don't think that's what it's saying. I think what it's saying is, as a Christian, despite how wonderful your family is and your health and your life and your job and all that kind of stuff, don't you still look forward to going to heaven whenever you die? I mean, I think that's what it's talking about. So there's no reason for us to feel conflict. I think it's easier for somebody who's really old and in pain and having a hard time getting around to say, I'm really looking forward to heaven, than it is for somebody who's 35 with a fantastic spouse and two lovely kids. No.
I think we all, in the context of this tree here, are eagerly waiting for him, knowing that we're imperfect and knowing that we have sinned, but we can get that sin forgiven. And we are eagerly waiting, not that we want it to happen right now, but whenever it happens.
Yeah.
That's out of our control.
Yeah. And plus, what is almost always said at the funeral of a Christian? That this life is not the end. So I eagerly await the afterlife, totally contrary to what a person who doesn't believe in God at all, or a person who's willfully sinning all the time, he's not looking forward to the end. In fact, he's dreading the end, because to him there's nothing else after this. I mean, if he really believed there was something else, he'd do something about it. But he doesn't. So I'm eagerly anticipating that, knowing that when my days are over, there is an afterlife. So I'm eagerly awaiting that. I'm not ready to, you know, commit suicide or walk out in front of the traffic tonight, but whenever the time comes, it's going to be a happy time. Jimmy? Is that bell one or bell two? Bell one, okay.
Back to earlier chapter 5 where we read that he learned
Well, not only that, Jimmy, but to enhance it even more, he came to earth knowing that that was his purpose for being here and knowing that he was going to go through with it.
That's why we should trust in him and we should obey him and follow him, but there's plenty of reason for it.
Yeah. Well, we didn't get as much cover tonight, but these are heavy verses, and I don't regret that we didn't get much farther, but we'll go ahead. Let's read the first four verses of chapter 10. I think we'll make faster time next week. For the law, the Old Testament law, since it has only a shadow of the good things to come and not the very form of those things, can never by the same sacrifices which they offer continually year by year make perfect those who draw near. Well, he's made that point repeatedly several times. Otherwise, would they not have ceased to be offered because the worshipers, having once been cleansed, would no longer have had the consciousness of sins? He throws in these little doses of practical, logical reality. You know, if you could get forgiveness with these Old Testament sacrifices, then you wouldn't have to keep doing it because they'd all be cleansed, but they're not. But in those sacrifices, there is a reminder of sins year by year. So they weren't forgiven, they were remembered year by year. For it's impossible for the blood of bulls and goats to take away sins. And he'll start making the case that Jesus' blood can take away sins. And then he goes back to the Old Testament passage of Psalm 40, which I think we've already studied at some time in the past, and he quotes that. And it's very interesting. He quotes it. And why does he quote it? Because they knew it. He says, I'm going to quote a psalm for you. And then he goes on in the next verse after he quotes several verses of this psalm, and he interprets what the meaning of the psalm was for them. Is that a buzzer? So we got a messianic psalm in Psalm 40. And the only way you can know if something is a messianic psalm is if the New Testament tells you it's a messianic psalm. Otherwise, we're just guessing. But anyway, we'll start in Hebrews 10:5 next time. I greatly appreciate your comments. And Troy, I greatly appreciate your fact checking.